Welcome to Under the Abbey Stand. As you've seen from the episode title, this is a very special episode with none other than the news gaffer, Neil Harris. Right now, I'm not joined by Neil Harris. I'm joined by Jordan Morland. A slight downgrade, I will say, George. But we have just both been chatting to Neil Harris for an hour. That was great, wasn't it?
I'm sat where Neil Harris was sat, trying to emulate him, trying to be the gaffer.
What you're not getting is as many as he was calls from agents on his watch. At one point, I felt a bit pinging away. I felt a bit like, God, you actually should probably answer that, because if we miss out on a play because you've been chatting to us.
It's like Monday afternoon, window shuts in a couple of days, like, and yet he's still found the time to come and chat to us about pubs in Cambridge and Cambridge City and all that stuff.
It was brilliant. I mean, such a lovely bloke you're about to hear. It's great to actually just sort of get to know him a little bit more as a person and his career. And
well, I mean, the moment that he heaped praise on Wesley Houlihan, I'm like, I think we're gonna get on.
I think we're gonna
be all right. That's why, you know, I went easy on him at the end of the pod. That's all I'm saying.
Is that what it was? Yeah. The Jenga at the end is not George's finest hour, let's say, but it's...
Don't try and be smart when you're playing Jenga.
Yeah.
It's my idea.
Always think of the manager first. That's my tip for Jenga. Get that in your head first.
Says the man that didn't know who the manager was.
I didn't know who the manager was, and I couldn't search it quick enough because I didn't have him on the sheet in front of me. Anyway, you'll hear that right at the end of the pod. Before that, we talk about his playing career, managerial career, how he came to the U's, and then a lot of chat about his plan for the U's and what was, you know, so appealing to him about coming to Cambridge United. George, just one thing I wanted to say that off mic, we're obviously recording this at Portland Arms, as you'll hear, we mentioned that, which is right around the corner from Milton Road, the Cambridge City Stadium. Mm-hmm. And just as we were walking up the stairs when we first arrived, we said, oh, you're obviously around the corner from the old ground. He went, yeah, I can't go there. No way can I see that. I thought it was such a sweet moment. Like, he was pretty serious. I can't go around there and see all the new houses that have replaced the ground.
Yeah. No, that was touching.
It was sentimental.
And then I guess there is that sort of side to him that came out in the pod, because we spoke a lot about sort of, you know, his history with illness and stuff as well, which I think perhaps you forget about. You just see him as the manager, but hearing about some of the stuff that he went through on his journey to being here is really interesting, and it kind of makes the manager who he is.
We've got quite used to him being Cambridge United manager, and I suppose before that, where people most recently would have seen him would have been at Gillingham, a club that got relegated when we were in the same division as them. And there was just a part of me, when you go through his career and he's talking about, you know, playing an FA Cup final against Man United, like being one game away from getting Cardiff promoted to Wembley to the Premier League as a manager, like there was just a part of me that went, God, like this guy's history in the game is so deep and long that actually, like, we may be sort of underplaying how sort of big a coup it is for us as a manager. I don't know. That was sort of my reflection of it.
Yeah, I've always thought, on that kind of sort of idea about whether he is a coup or not, if it wasn't for the Gillingham job, you'd definitely say he wouldn't be here. You know, what he achieved at, you know, at Millwall and Cardiff and being in the Championship and so forth. So, yeah, it is interesting how, like, that Gillingham role has perhaps changed a few things. So, like, you know, making him attainable for us, or, you know, let's not discount ourselves. We are also a League One club now. We kind of sometimes forget that when we're sort of approaching people. But also, he spoke in the pod when I asked him about sort of style of play, and he sort of meant it felt like the Gillingham job in his eyes kind of sort of maybe tarnished his reputation in terms of the football that he wants to play. And it feels a little bit like what we're seeing ourselves on the odd occasion, is that he has got more in his locker than being that ugly direct tactician and stylist. But what he keeps coming back to, which I think is really quite emotive, And it relates to this topic as well, as that Millwall upbringing, that Millwall culture, not the bad stuff, not the scrapping and all that, but the kind of, it's a community club. There's a lot of heart there, but also because, you know, you get it done. There's the passion there. It doesn't matter how it gets done. You just get it done. And whether that's with flair or whether that's doing it a little bit dirty, then it happens. And I think that's a really good approach for us to take, because we are in a league where perhaps we are a small dog in the league, and we are perhaps sort of punching above our weight a tiny bit being here. So getting it done and surviving is key.
Yeah, and that sort of connection that he has with Millwall fans, I think you can tell that he really wants to build that with us, and it seems like quite an important thing for him as a manager. So anyway, enough of us. Everyone wants to listen to Neil Harris. Here's the interview. Enjoy. Right then, Under the Abbey Sand listeners, we've got a very special episode today. Me and Jordan are joined in the studio by Neil Harris. I was going to say new Cambridge United manager, but not so new anymore.
I still feel a freshness to it, I've got to be honest.
Feet under the table, though.
Yeah, I wouldn't say feet under the table yet. I mean, there's a few tables I've got to get round to first. But I'm now very much enjoying it. That's the main thing. Thank you for having me on today. Really excited about being here, and obviously getting to know you guys.
Yeah, absolute pleasure to have you on, mate. I think
do we call you Neil or do we call you Bomber? What's your preference?
I've been called a lot worse, and normally at home. So I'd rather you call me Neil. Rather than gaffer or anything like that. And I say that to the staff at the training. I am the boss. I have to be the boss at the training. Yeah, but once we're at the office, if we're on the coach or we're we're maybe having a light owl at some stage at the right time, obviously.
Yeah.
Then I'd like to be Neil or Chopper.
Yeah, Chopper.
Chopper.
Yeah, Chopper. Yeah,
that was my nickname. Growing up as a kid.
That's great.
Chopper's what the nickname you give like defenders, right? For like hacking people down. How did Chopper come about?
Ron Chopper Harris,
who used to
hack people down regularly for Chelsea.
There you go.
My old PE teacher at school, when I went to senior school when I was 11, was a massive Chelsea fan. So as soon as Neil Harris walked in, it was Chopper. Okay. It just stuck ever since, all through my career as well.
Also you, I mean, of all the strikers that have embodied hacking people down up top, maybe that was your game as well.
I did pick up, I don't think the listeners would be surprised to hear after my yellow card at the weekend.
Yeah.
I have picked up a fair number of red cards, I'm not embarrassed to say, and they weren't for chopping people down, they're more use of elbows maybe.
Yeah. Do you have like fines for like showing up late for training, getting yellow cards, red cards, and if so, did you have to do something on Saturday because you got your yellow?
Yeah, I look back now and think, maybe I'd have been better off not getting sent off and putting that in the children's bank account.
Yeah.
on a serious note, I do say to my players, like, if it's a regular, like Paul Digby, Blackpool, wasn't it? I think he got his red. But I didn't find
him for
that.
He's got two, you're thinking. The other one was Northampton, which was quite impressive.
Yeah.
Two yellows in 30 seconds.
But the one against Blackpool was a late challenge and he was trying to do the right thing. So he doesn't get a fine for that, in my book. So the club have a fine policy. The players have their fine policy run by Michael. And then I sort of have the manager's fine as well. It wasn't a fine for Paul because it was a late challenge and he was quite late actually. But he was trying to do the right thing, so that's not. But dissent, stupid things. Then there has to be a manager's fine to it because it does impact us. And I've had to pay my fair share of fines as well when I've been the recorded as a manager.
We're in this little game that we started at start of season. So you predict top scorer, top assist, most yellows, most reds, and there's 10 of us playing.
Yeah.
None of us predicted Paul Digby for most red cards.
Yeah.
He's way out in front.
Okay.
I might change one to Neil Harris.
I'm trying my best to behave myself.
Anyway, look, today obviously we're going to talk. This is a bit of an opportunity for all our listeners to sort of get to know a bit more who Neil Harris is, the player, the manager, the person, obviously a little bit as well. We'll talk about your playing career, managerial career, future plans for the U's. But before we do that, let's just do a quick 5 minutes. We're recording this on the 29th of January, a couple of days after 0-0 draw at home with Burton. 48 hours after the game or so. How are you feeling about it? Are you feeling frustrated, reflecting on it a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's the word that Dan used in obviously the media team afterwards. He said, Neil, do you feel frustrated? And I was trying to be glass half full because certainly in the first half hour, we played really well. I think we showed we're a much better team than Burton. You know, a team that's level points, similar goal difference, etc. We showed we're the better team. And so I was pleased with a lot of aspects of it. But ultimately, games are defined by both boxes. And as much as we stood up to the long ball approach and the ball in the box, and we stood up really well to it and give very little away, 11v11, let alone 11v10, did we do enough in the opponent's box? For me, no, we didn't. Scoreline sort of shows that, but did we create enough clear gut chances? Were we brave enough? Were we aggressive enough with the ball? I'm not sure. I thought we decision making was off at times. I think I've got some quality players in the group, especially the top end of the pitch, that have got more to show me and show the fan base. I felt we had good players on the pitch at the end of the game. Just we didn't have that moment. That the one real moment came to Elias right at the end. Yeah. And
it's a good save, yeah, by the way.
It was good. I think the goalie did well to stand up for so long. But I think Elias, with his quality, as we know, and his pedigree from where he's been, you know, I think should be fine in the bottom corner in that.
Do you know, in that sort of game where, like, you're sort of knocking at the door and you know you're going to get one chance and then it goes. It's so, like, there's a moment where you just stand there and you go, oh, that's that.
Well, I was having a debate with a guy I've stood with, because that was like, 9 minutes of injury time, and that was like 6 or 7 in. I was like, oh, that's it. I was with you. I was that's a chance. Yeah. My mate's like, no, we're going to get one more. Okay, get one more.
I'd say Adam May's quality.
When he came on,
you'll get one moment, you'll get one effort from 15 to 25 yards, hit the target.
Yeah.
So I think if Ads hits the target, he finds the bottom corner.
Yeah.
And he did right at the last kick of the game.
Yeah,
he had the shot, he bent from the edge of the box, keeper saved it. He doesn't quite connect with it properly. If he hits it properly, I think he might find the back of the net. So I thought we had one more half chance, but ultimately, did we do enough? And sometimes you have to say fair play to the opponent.
Yeah, it's true.
We went to Exeter and I was really pleased afterwards, and it was a bit of a poor draw, but I was really proud of the players and the group, the fans that travelled, and the performance we put in to stand up to get a clean sheet. I hadn't had many away from home recently, so I was really pleased with that. So you have to say fair play to Burton as well. They came to get a clean sheet and they got it.
That's true. That was such a bizarre one, Exeter. I was on the train down, like, only found out the game was on when we got to about Taunton. So
you're mad. It was for us as well. You know, it was the first pitch inspection was Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
We left the training ground about just before midday. So we was 2.5 hours into the journey on the way to Devon before we found out that he had a chance for Saturday. I kept the second one away from the players as much as possible. Then it was announced
on Twitter.
Yeah, and I was like, all right, okay. So the lads were like, oh, so there is a chance of being up. I was like, no, it's definitely going to be on.
Yeah. Anyway, then the other question obviously was just 29th of January, a couple of days out from the deadline. I'm not going to ask you too many details, but I was just wondering, January must be such a stressful time to be a manager. And it's, on the pod every week, we do a call out for questions. And from about, what would you say, Jordan? November, we get like,
who are you signing?
Who are we signing in January?
What names? Like, no idea.
Yeah.
But it must just be a crazy time to be a manager, though.
It's the worst week, right? The last one?
It can be. I'm sort of, this is my 9th January now, really, doing it. And so I'm a little bit more, laid back's the wrong, I'm not laid back with it at all. But more understanding to what happens in January. Like last week, I pretty much alluded to in my Thursday press conference that we was going to sign one player, maybe two, Thursday afternoon and Friday morning, and we end up with neither.
Yep.
And I was gobsmacked that we didn't sign at least one of them. And it certainly wasn't our fault, by the way. It was certainly nothing to do with behind the scenes. And that was just, that reminded me, gave me a little kick up the backside, is why I try and speak really honestly. Because if you try and guide the people too much, you set yourself up for a fall.
I shot
myself in the foot with that one. We pretty much agreed a player before I've just come on air. So, you know, pretty much got one in the door. I've got to be honest, until a player turns up and actually signs, like Lyle did a couple of weeks ago, and I do get quite nervous in January. So, as far as I'm concerned, a player is travelling to Cambridge here at the moment to sign
lucky
for us.
Lucky player.
So, on his way to Portland Arms.
So, he's travelling at the moment. But we're trying our best, you know, been quite clear of what we need. And I've been quite clear, you know, been honest with the players, what we need as well. So, you know, we need to sign those players. But it's not, everyone says it's not easy. And honestly, I wish you guys could be, I wish there was sort of more transparency. You know, you've seen it on like the Wrexham documentary, the Sunderland ones, where see behind the scenes, they sign a player and they haven't. And then all of a sudden, instead of spending $500,000, they spent $9 million on a player. We're not spending $9 million, by the way, on a player. But that is generally what happens. You do a player, then it's off.
Yeah.
And then as you think you're doing the player's sitting in a boardroom somewhere else, sign for somebody else. It can be that bizarre. I've seen it so many different
silly
ways.
Silly season, isn't it? You also forget there's a player at the end of it who's got like a life and like a, do you know what I mean, where they live, and like, it must be so cute.
Kids at school and all
kids
that,
at school and
from a player perspective, yes, hugely. And then you have to factor in agents. There are some good agents out there, but there's some absolute bleep as well that you just can't absolutely do you over for a £5 note.
Anyway, look, let's stay away from January because obviously that's not what we're here to talk about too much. Let's go right back. Let's rewind right back to the start of Neil Harris's footballing career. We're sat in the Portland Arms right now, which, if you know Cambridge well, you'll know is at the end of Milton Road with Mitchell's Corner. And Milton Road will be a name that many football fans in the Cambridge area will know for being Cambridge City's beautiful old stadium, which is where you started your career. Do you want to tell us how that came about? That's really where you made your breakthrough, right, in the game?
Yeah, it was. Special memories for me in and my family, I've got to be honest, in Cambridge. I was playing in, I think, the Juicen League at the time, which I think is now the Thurlow Nun League.
Okay.
And I was playing for Maldon Town.
Is that where you're from?
So I'm a Mystic boy. So mm-hmm. A place called Rayleigh.
Okay.
Which is about 60 miles from here. So it was a nice little drive in the morning in and out. But Cambridge was sort of like, at the time, for 15 months, was sort of my second home. I was here Tuesday, Thursday, Saturdays. I would stay over quite often as well. My family, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and my parents always supported me, always come to home and away games. So, you know, got a real family connection with Cambridge. But Milton Road was special for me because it gave me that link between sort of what I'd say is sort of non-league town football to sort of national. You know, I was playing in the Dr. Martin's Premier at the time and travelling, you know, Merthyr Tydfil, Worcester City, Cheltenham Town. A lot of different places around the country at the time. So it opened up, but that also gave me the foothold and the stepping stone to go on to the Football League.
Yeah, and Graham Danners was the manager there, right?
He was, yeah, what a bloke. Yeah. What a legend of the game. What a nice bloke. You know, great to have that connection with him again at United. He was the manager. He signed me. I think he paid £4,000 for me from Maldon. Which he does like to tell.
That's about nine. That's about £9 million these days, right? Yeah.
He does. If you don't know the story, he's told everybody else in Cambridge here the story about signing me for £4,000 and selling me a year later for £100,000.
Wow. What a bit of business. That is,
yeah, I had a great time and Milton Road. I know he's United head coach. Don't always talk about City, but I think the rivalry's got slightly further apart since when I played in it. Mm-hmm. Traditional football club, traditional ground, fond memories for me. I do know this pub.
Yeah.
did United ever come sniffing? Because obviously banging them in non-league just around the corner from the Abbey, like you mentioned, you got sold for 100k there, but were there other suitors and were Cambridge United one of them? Was there ever any inquiry that you know about?
Cambridge were keen, but just don't think at the price.
Yeah,
I think that's what put Cambridge off. I think
I was thinking about this earlier.
Was it Roy
McFarlane?
Well, we went up under McFarlane in '99, and what were you, '96, '98? So yeah, it would have been McFarlane for a bit.
'97, '98.
Gary Johnson or Tommy Taylor maybe before.
Yeah, might have been Tommy. Yes, yeah. I think it was Tom. Yeah.
Oh, actually, went to Orient.
Yeah. We've got mutual friend. I think it might have been Tom. So there was interest, obviously. Huddersfield. We're trying to do it. Russian and Diamonds.
Really?
Yeah, but not the listeners. Sorry, guys, you won't know who Russian and Diamonds are. we're obviously in the league at the time.
I read an article that you were doing trials abroad and stuff as well, and like Liverpool were involved.
Yeah, Liverpool twice. Wow. Liverpool I actually thought I was signing for Liverpool.
That's incredible.
Yeah, Liverpool twice.
You must be the only player in history to have done Cambridge City to Liverpool if that had happened.
Yeah, by Leverkusen and Cologne.
Wow.
Two German clubs.
How do they end up scouting at Milton Road?
Tony Wilcox, big friend of Graham Daniels.
Yeah, okay.
And Tony was obviously in Germany at the time when he'd moved abroad as a player to Cologne. So that was the link. So I went and stayed with Tony a couple of times when both of them got for the contract at Cologne, I think. Yeah, got
for. Not tempted?
Too far.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah.
Slightly more than a 60-mile drive.
Yeah. It wasn't just a big night at the Portland Arms and they thought, should we just pop around the corner and see what's going on there? Oh, it's great. I would ask her, so is it nice to be sort of returning back to Cambridge as a manager now, obviously, at United, like, as a city? Is it somewhere that you've... That, you know, is there any old haunts that you're sort of revisiting a little bit?
We can't talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like when I played here, I was obviously a young man. I was 19 at the time, so finding my way in life as well. And we had a cracking group of fellas, ex-United players, four or five ex-United players. And I say it was sort of my apprenticeship, really. I worked in London at the time, worked in the city, and used to get the train down or shoot home to get the car and drive up. My life was working and playing. Like I said, the connection for me and my family to Cambridge is phenomenal. It is really, really strong for us. And I thought my opportunity, you know, I missed it as a player. Thought I wouldn't come back and play. So I wasn't sure what happened as a head coach or a manager. So when the opportunity arose, it was Really strong bond for us.
Reached the pinnacle of your managerial career, I'm sure we can all agree.
Yes.
In the home dugout at United. And then obviously Millwall chose you. And that was, I'll tell you that when the announcement came out that you'd joined United for our pod, I spoke to a Millwall, like equivalent pod, just to get a bit of a, you know, we didn't know too much about you and we just got a bit of a sort of intro from him. And obviously you'll imagine how he spoke about you. And I was telling Jordan when we were writing this, I was thinking back to it and I was thinking, it's actually quite rare that you get such a strong relationship with a fan base. Was it 400 appearances, lead all-time goal scorer, and then the managerial career after? I was trying to think of...
But success as a manager, right?
Is that right?
Because we couldn't think of people that had done success as both. Like we could think of people that failed at one, or failed or did all right at one, but not so well at the other, you know.
A pretty good example is like John Beck at United, who was a player, but he was at the end of his career, he was tailing off. Like I wouldn't describe him as a legend as a player.
Yeah.
Obviously as a manager, it's a completely different story.
Well, Shaggy was like top league scorer for us, but then couldn't quite do it as a manager.
But so that relationship with Millwall, how do you look back on those times? First stint, let's say.
Yeah, obviously very fond. I had a great time. Again, it was huge moments. A lot happened in my life as a young Millwall player, from having my first opportunity in the professional game to having huge success as a player, as a young player as well, playing with so many good players and, you know, promotions and playoff finals and you know, very close to the Premier League, but then obviously being diagnosed with a serious illness as well. Mm-hmm. So I went through a lot. Two of my children born during my time as a player for Millwall as well, two different spells. So that's quite amazing as well, to have that connection. So I've got nothing but fond memories of being a player at Millwall, but also the manager as well. Like I said, I had a successful time, and to do sort of 4.5 years in your first job is, you know, it's tough. It's tough because it does sort of wear you down.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the illness, if you don't mind talking about it as a experience. Like that must have been, I mean, such a young man to go through something like that, it must have been so hard.
Yeah, I've talked a lot, and I do sort of after dinner speaking and things like that on it as well, because you know, it's so important that I portray my message to people. People always say to me, "Oh, do you feel really unlucky that you?" I was very close to going to Tottenham when I was diagnosed. You know, probably the week after, to be honest. So people say, "Oh, you just feel really unlucky that you missed out," and I'm like, "No, you don't realise how lucky I feel I am." If I hadn't been in the fortunate position to have been comfortable in the change room environment with my peers around me, with a club doctor that I was very friendly with, if I hadn't been in that position to be brave enough to report what I felt, a lump or something slightly wrong, then my life, could be very, very different sitting here today. Yeah. So I look at it, I was very lucky. And the message to everybody is, you know, women are brilliant. They talk about breast cancer and they're very open with it, and they sit and talk about it in the pub. But as guys, you know, sitting having a couple of pints of beer, we won't always talk about stress or illnesses and things like that, worries. But it's important. It's important that every person out there, every male person out there checks testicles. And if you're not sure of anything, then speak to your GP.
Absolutely. Yeah, great message. Was it ever close to like ending your career or anything? Was it ever at that point?
As time went on, no. You know, I was very fortunate. My recovery was, you know, was very fast. So fast was 6 months, really, but it was quick. But at the time when I was diagnosed, the worry was survival rate. Mm-hmm. You know, when they say 98% survival rate, well, that's fantastic, guys. But what about the 2%? What about the 2 out of every 100? Am I one of those two? So that's the worry. And then secondly, my second question was, you know, would I be able to play football again? Which, again, is impossible for a doctor that's just diagnosed you with cancer to tell you if you're going to have a football career. And thirdly, then dawned on me very quickly, is what about children?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, children. And I've had three since, so fortunately, all in working order.
Well, congratulations, mate.
Thank you.
Thank God. Thank God you got through that. And then, you know, on the pitch, FA Cup final 2004, that must have been a...
Yeah, because you didn't mention the FA Cup final when you mentioned promotion. So I was like, I thought that's where you'd jump to first, you know.
Great privileged. Yeah. As a young man growing up, you know, is the FA Cup the same as it was sort of when...
Wasn't it Wembley as well, like, right? Was it Cardiff?
It was Cardiff, unfortunately. Yeah, it's only disappointing the day. It was two disappointing facts on the day. One, it wasn't at Wembley, and two, I didn't really touch the ball because we were playing Man United.
Yeah.
But when you look back to this weekend and look at sort of Maidstone.
Yeah.
Ipswich, and you look a little bit at Newport yesterday to a certain degree, and you're looking, thinking, well, look, that's what the FA Cup's all about, really. And then, you know, I was fortunate to play in the Cup Final, grew up watching Cup Finals and dreaming of being on that pitch. So that was obviously a special moment.
Did you get anyone's shirt from the Cup Final? Did you not do that?
Two shirts. I didn't want to swap.
Yeah.
One, I wanted to give to my father, mm-hmm. for sort of giving me my career and turning me into sort of the human being that I'd like to think I am.
Yeah.
And the second one I wanted to keep for myself.
Nice.
And keep for my family.
Yeah. Big one. Yeah. And you also taught Tim Cahill everything he knew, I imagine, in that period as well.
Yes. I was lucky to play with some really good players. You know, not just at Millwall, but during my career as well, Cardiff and Forest, and you know, some really good players. And Timmy was special, obviously, because you know he had the knack of being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, yeah, what a player! Got such good memories of him from the 2000, like that sort of era, punching the corner flag. It's proper like. Well, for me,
forget that he proper went through the leagues, didn't he, Tim Cahill? Was sort of League One, League Two.
I thought he started his career at Millwood.
He went through the leagues with Millwood. Before
he went from League One to the Championship, and then he had a good spell, and then got sold to Everton.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously that was his. He had a long time at Everton, and then obviously international career speaks for itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then obviously Cardiff, Forest, Gillingham. Then you end your career at Southend, and there's only one person I want to ask about at Southend, Mr. Barry Corr.
Barry Corr. Yeah, what a guy. Yeah.
So at the time, he must have been
injured. Yeah, he was injured. Yeah, yeah.
I was going to ask, like, there must have been a point like a few weeks ago when like strikers are dropping like flies at United. Were you tempted to sort of say like, come on, Barry, can you do a couple of weeks? You know,
me and Baz, we were okay as a pair. You know, we didn't play often together because he was injured for the first. Well, most of my first season, then I was injured for the most of my second season. So we didn't get long together. But he was a good player. Baz, he was very, very unfortunate with injuries.
Do you know, we were talking about debuts the other day on the pod, and after Taylor, obviously.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't a bad debut, Lars, was it?
Oh, not bad, was it?
Yeah.
What about your debuts? So go for each of them, like Millwall, Gillingham, Cardiff Forest, any memorable ones, or were they all?
No.
No. Did you score on any of them?
Just trying to think. I remember my Forest debut was at Upton Park.
Nice, yeah.
At West Ham, which obviously I'm very popular there.
Yeah, as
the Cheltenham fans, the Cambridge fans realised at Cheltenham that I'm not overly popular at Cheltenham either. Yeah, it doesn't go well at Palace either when I go there.
Yeah. Who did you grow up supporting if you're in Essex? Was it
Southend?
Southend, okay. Yeah, so West Ham, I know, quite popular, but.
Yeah, not for me that.
Yeah, good.
Am I right in saying you were the last Millwall player to score against West Ham?
Ever or Upton Park?
Upton Park.
I think there was a 1-1 draw after I left.
Right,
it was a 1-1 draw.
Yeah, yeah.
Timmy might have scored a header.
Yeah, I think, bloody Cahill again.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Look, here's a couple of just sort of quick fire ones just throughout your career. What was the best moment, do you think, of your playing career? One that really sticks in your head?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, my first goal back from when after my illness and my treatment was away at Watford, New Year's Day 2002. Special moment. The reason it's so special, it's an iconic moment in Millwall's history, not just because of we won the game and I scored a goal. It was the biggest thing for me was the reaction, A, for my family, but B, for my peers on the football pitch. My peers lifted me above their shoulder.
Oh, nice.
And they basically elevated me above them, which was a special moment. And that's why out of that group at that time, so many good friends.
Amazing. Maybe it's the same answer. What's the best goal you've ever scored, though? But I mean, like the one that you're proudest of in terms of technique.
That was obviously a special moment.
Yeah.
Technique-wise, I've got two, actually. One was a left foot volley at Tranmere in the quarter final of the FA Cup, which got us through to the semi final against Sunderland. And the other one was probably my record breaking goal for Millwall at Crewe. It was a horrific goal. Well, actually, all goals are good goals. As I said, all goals are good goals. But it was very, very scruffy.
Yeah,
it was definitely a poacher's finish in the 6-yard box.
As long as it goes in,
that's
all that matters.
Yeah, I think it crossed the line. It went down as crossing the line.
Here's one. What's the best goal you've seen scored against a team that you've been managing? So, like, as a manager, the best goal you've seen someone score against you?
Do you know one where you sort of go...
finish. Adam Armstrong.
Yeah.
For commentary. Yeah. My first full season as manager. First home game, you think, here we go, good start. Mm-hmm. Coventry, I'm coming, let's get off to a flying start. Yeah. Lost 4-0.
Yes.
And he scored from the halfway line.
Oh, amazing.
And you think, right, it can only get better after this. Yeah. Fortunately, it did get better. We got to the playoff final, but yeah.
It
was a cracking goal.
Those sorts of goals are brilliant when you're just like, when all you can do, like even every fan in the stadium just sort of goes, yeah, fair enough, just sort of give him that one. I remember Graham Carey scoring a goal for Plymouth against us at the Abbey that stopped us getting in the playoffs. It was just a screamer from 35 yards. Mm. Anyway, completely besides the point. Sorry, I got Neil Harris in front of me.
I remember someone scoring from a different postcode against us.
Yeah, against Luton. Okay, how about this one? If you could add any player you played with as a player to this United squad, who would it be?
Oh,
you can't say KO again, right? You can't say KO.
Yeah, no,
again.
I can't keep mentioning him. No,
it's too much of him on this pod already. Unless he's available.
That's a tough one. I know.
It is a really, really tough one. Got a place, good place. I'd probably go with Andy Reid.
Okay, yeah.
Played with him at Forest.
Forest, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. His ability with the ball, his work ethic was great. We got him a multi-million-pound move to, I think, for about £6 million back in the day, Spurs, which now would be probably 20 or 30 million. Yeah. Score out of nothing off both feet.
Yeah.
Create out of nothing. Set pieces were a joke. Maybe just at the moment, that little spark would be really good for us.
Yeah, yeah.
I really hope Barry Corr's listening.
He was very, very close to second, obviously. Yeah.
We'll go on to your managerial career in a second, but I've just thought, did you ever play against Wes Hoolahan?
Yes, yeah, various times. Nice. Yes. Yeah. He was all right.
He was a good player, wasn't he?
He used to get right on my nerves. He couldn't get the ball off him.
He's an absolute magician, wasn't he?
Loved it to you that brought Wes up in the pod. It's normally
just
me, right?
It popped into my mind. Okay, look, managerial career. So then obviously you're back at Millwall coaching the under-21s.
Yes.
Go through the academy. And then you get made caretaker manager. Was it just temporary at first and then another spell? Permanent or was
So when Steve Lomas left, be back I think probably 2012, I want to say, would be my guess. Mm-hmm. I had a 3-game spell then, and I didn't really want to do it, but a football club asked, and you know, I always knew somebody was coming in, so that was a good little intro, just like a 10-day period. Certainly made me realise how tough it is over that 10-day period. For whoever does this must be mad. And then when Ollie left, they asked me again to do it over a period, and the agreement was very clear to start with. It was like, I was doing it for a period. If I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't do it longer term. If I wasn't very good at it, I wouldn't do it. If I really wanted to do it, then I would do it. So I had a 10-game period where it was a real good eye opener, good learning curve. Did I get on with the players? Did I enjoy the day to day? Did I enjoy the preparation, match day, the media? Scrutiny, etc., and I got goodness, I really, really enjoyed it, and that's why I took over full time.
Yeah, amazing. Was it always something? So, was it something that you'd imagined your career going into at all?
I decided from quite, I think, 27 when I started my coaching badges. Yeah. PFA were really instrumental in my career. I didn't have an agent for a long time. PFA represented me, so I was always the thought process of what was I going to do next. Obviously, I'd come into the game late. 20, almost 21. I'd worked in the city for 3 years. So I had a background to do something different. I had an education. So it was, so what was I going to do next? Was it going to go back into the city and do something? But I love football. Grew up as a kid, I love it. I'm a massive England fan. I love travelling around Europe to watch England. I've always been a Southend season ticket holder as a kid growing up. So as a football fan, I thought, well, I'd want to stay in the game. What do I do? People say, oh, did you know you want to be a manager? I thought I wanted to manage. Really was intrigued with the managerial side of it. But I don't think you generally know until you start coaching whether you cut out for it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to coach. I started my coaching badge at 27. Didn't finish my pro licence till 38. So that's how long it can take. Sort of 10 years. That's how long it should take, really. It should take one stage at a time while you're still playing. So as soon as I started coaching badges, I loved it. Mm-hmm. And the harder they got, the more intense they got, the deeper they got into the thought process, the more I enjoyed it.
Didn't fancy being an agent then? No.
Like I said earlier, there's some nice ones out there that I speak very well of, but the other 90%, no.
When you look back at your time at Millwall, do you think we sort of just exceeded all expectations, or did you not really expect anything
when you sort of started the management job? Like, did you just go into it sort of trying to just get to the end of the season and do best you can? Or
yeah, I first and foremost, I work for a guy, John Berylson, who sadly passed away this year, who was just an absolute class act, absolute class man, who was a huge source of energy for me, someone to lean on, someone to look up to, someone to support me. Didn't put pressure on me at all as a first-time manager, just helped me find my way, supported me in every aspect of the job. So I was really fortunate in that, and I was at a place where I knew what a Millwall team looked like, and how a Millwall team should play, and what it takes to be a successful Millwall manager. Obviously, have you then got the ability to make big decisions, the right decisions? Do you get the luck? Do you not? That all comes with, you know, the territory of learning your trade. But as a football club, I knew what was needed. 4.5 years exceed expectation. Well, the plan was to take step by step. You know, was to sort of steady the ship, adjust the group, not just personnel wise, but mentality wise as well, and then take step by step over sort of 4, 5, 6 transfer windows to try and get back to the Championship. We got there second attempt, lost the play final, then won a play final. So we got there slightly earlier, and then what we achieved in the Championship was, with almost getting to the Premier League, was sort of above sort of wildest dreams scenario. But all good things come to an end, and my time come to an end. Just, I was absolutely whacked. You know, I needed a break, and it was just the right time for everybody.
So when you saw the Klopp presser last week, and he's talking about being tired, did it just sort of land with you?
I know exactly where he's coming from.
Yeah.
I think every man just got empathy for him, and sympathy in some ways, empathy and sort of where he's at, and his family as well. But also, he's done 8 years at Liverpool, but it's not his first gig.
Yeah.
So he's done various jobs. So, you know, he's got more to give. You know, he can manage his time better. The biggest thing is managing your time and your self-care. And I just think, you know, people want success yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, we all talk about time as managers. Yeah, we need time. We need this. We need transfer windows. But that's not how society works anymore. It's not just, let's be honest, it's not just football. Not just your podcast, it's society itself. Everyone wants change so quickly. Yeah. So it just makes sense that you know, managers' lifespans will become shorter.
It's interesting that I thought Klopp used such an interesting analogy when he said like, it's like being in I'm a sports car and everyone's seeing me like drive along like top of the Premier League, but no one's seeing the fuel
in the gauge.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It is, and it's just you know, just experience just comes with that. You just have to try and find ways to manage yourself and your time. And like I said earlier about players being sort of human beings and, you know, families, we're the same.
Of course, yeah.
We're the same. We stand on the sideline on a Saturday afternoon, you know, and I'm in a really privileged position and a really proud Cambridge United head coach. But ultimately, I'm only trying to make the best decisions for the football team as the guys that the pub, the Portland Arms have got a football team on a Sunday morning, you know, a coach standing on the side trying to make the best decision for them as well. Ultimately, we're just trying to do the best you can. But obviously for me, just everything that comes with it, the scrutiny, the pressures, the decision making, the time away from the family, the long days, the coaching sessions. I do it because I love it. And Jurgen Klopp will be the same. And what I'll say, he's quite good at Jurgen Klopp as well, isn't he? Yeah. To be fair to him.
I was gonna ask as well that, like, you mentioned that obviously you'd come from a job in the city, you know, like a normal job, let's say, that, you know, outside of football, right? Obviously, a long time ago now. But
thanks very much.
It came out so wrong. Right, should we just start?
So wrong, but I understand where you come from, and I do.
You mean the city's changed so much since then? You know, with like financial crashes and all that.
Anyway. Okay, what I mean is, a lot of kids, footballers growing up, come through academy systems, right? Especially now, obviously, it's by far like 99.9% of them come through these academy systems, which are obviously quite like rigid, and you know, they get brought through in a particular way at a particular club. But did you, having like a slightly different background in football as a teenager, even, I assume, going to matches as a fan and like being a Southend United fan, and then playing on a Saturday or playing football. At an amateur level on the side, or semi-pro level even, do you think your appreciation for like what fans expect of their club, or the sort of like, even like how irrational fans can be. Do you know what I mean? You say fans expect success yesterday. Like, you know, there's no, I always say, like, you know, 2 weeks is such a long time in football, right? Like, it's just mad how quick a narrative can change in 2 weeks. Do you think you have a different appreciation for fan bases at every club you've been at than maybe people who haven't quite had that experience as a teenager like you had, if you sort of
Well, the first thing I would say, I would never change my pathway for anything.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't, I don't look back and think, oh, I wish I'd been a schoolboy, I wish I'd been a scholar somewhere. I could have been a scholar at Southend and Leighton Orient, and I said no to both and to follow the different pathway. And my apprenticeship was done, I class it as life apprenticeship rather than the football bubble.
Yeah.
And I love it. Does that give me the understanding of Joe Bloggs down on the sideline as a football fan? To a certain extent, I think it does. From a non-league background, the working man background, class is working man background. I think, but also, if you look at probably, you know, I won't apologise for saying my Millwall upbringing, sort of is a working man's environment.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I was taught very early on, it's not, you haven't got to be the best player on the pitch, but you have to give your all.
Yeah.
And that's, I talk to my players now about being a good Cambridge United team. What does a Cambridge United fan want to see? We want to see flair, they want to see goals, but they want to see someone have a right go for the amber shirt, and that's the biggest
thing. Wes Houlihan's ruined it, right? He's given us a glimpse of, of that skill. Everyone wants that back. No.
Yeah, but I ultimately look and just think, what does the football fan want to see? And I understand from having three beautiful children and how they live their lives on social media that the world just moves so fast. So I try and understand football is part of society. So if society wants things to move so fast, football's exactly the same. So I try and have empathy with the fan base. Ultimately, what I do understand is, as a football coach, you judge from results.
Yeah.
That never changed.
Do you reckon you would have made more money if you'd stuck out in the city? Do you reckon you'd be a billionaire by now, retired?
Billionaire banker by now.
A yacht somewhere.
That question's not on the running.
Yeah. Do you know what? I really enjoyed working in the city. My son works in there now, and I do.
Is it like Wolf on Wolf Street?
Just like that.
Chest pumping and all that.
Yeah. I did enjoy it. Yeah. I did enjoy it, and I loved non-league football. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, when I went sign a 2.5 year contract at Millwall, or 3 year deal, whatever it was, I always said, if it doesn't work out, I will go back to work in the city and play non-league football. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I was fortunate. That wasn't just Graham Daniels was a good influence on me. I was lucky that the teams I played with a lot of friends, and the fellas I played with at City were what a top group of guys.
Yeah, amazing. I was going to say, by the way, I just saw your phone ring. If that's a player, do feel free to take it.
It was actually an agent.
Don't let us stop you. So, okay, after Millwall.
If it's Wes calling, will you tell us?
Yeah. Right, so after Millwall, there's a spell at Cardiff, which I think people often brush over in your managerial career. I don't know why, people, because you've got such a strong association with
Cardiff. Get through so many managers, mate. You just forget who's been there.
An amazing spell there, right? Like,
playoff
semi-final.
What an experience.
Yeah, wow.
An amazing, amazing football club. For anyone who doesn't realise, Cardiff's the capital of Wales.
Yeah.
Which sounds a bonkers thing. I'm not disrespecting anybody, but you sort of, we're in England.
Yeah.
Sort of English Football League. Cardiff and Swansea, Wrexham, Newport, all part of it. But you actually get down there and actually forget that Cardiff, front page of the national newspaper, back page of the national newspaper, anything to do with Cardiff. You go out for a meal with your wife, you're pictured at a dinner table and you're in the newspaper. It's a bit like the billionaire celebs in England and America. Yeah. That's what it's like in Wales and at Cardiff. So that was a fantastic experience. Absolutely bonkers football club at times. But I had a great time.
Who was the owner when you were there?
Vincent Tan.
That's where I was thinking. Yeah. What was that like?
It's a bonkers football club. brilliant with me.
Yeah.
I had a brilliant working relationship with him. What a cracking guy. But they just had a year in the Premier League. They got promoted over the year in the Premier League. They come out of the Premier League, and Neil Warnock had done a brilliant job. But then sort of just things have to change. I took over a really talented squad, but sort of, in some ways, a talented squad, but misfits as well. Sort of pieced together, and I really enjoyed working with them. I really did, and we got so close. Unfortunately, we just ran into a Fulham side that were very, very good, and spent a lot of money, and were really talented, and they beat us by the odd goal over two legs, because we knew whoever won that game, that semi-final, was going to win the final. You know, we just knew whether we'd, I spoke to Scott Parker in the build up to the game, and we knew that whoever won was going to win the final because Brentford were on the decline at the time. And
well, half the Brentford fans, she's going to be livid at this. Yeah.
Well, they've done all right since. Promoted the year after. But so that was very close. It was a really enjoyable time.
Was that in the COVID summer?
Yeah, the final. Yes, the final was empty. Yeah. I remember watching it with Sinead, because obviously Brentford were in it, and there's just no one in the in Wembley.
Yeah, bizarre,
that was a great experience, and. Yeah, that's a real, real close call getting to the promised land.
Yeah, amazing. And then, okay, well, obviously we'll come on to Cambridge United in a second, but just to touch on this, which might be something that you're not, you know, you maybe can't say too much on this, but I think you were sacked somewhat surprisingly at Gillingham in your last role, sitting fourth in League Two.
I think we were in the top three for the first 10 games, dropped to fourth, and then there was a game on the Sunday, I think, which put us to eighth on goal difference from fourth. Yeah.
It's just not good enough, Neil, to be honest.
It wasn't, no. It did, I've got to be honest, it did come as a bit of a surprise. I wasn't expecting it when it would work on the Monday morning or Thursday morning. I think it was a Thursday morning, actually. Yeah, I didn't expect it. So it did come out of the blue. I can't speak too much about it, but
we don't want you getting sued, mate.
No, yeah, no, it was, it was
charge that back to us.
It was a wonderfully interesting experience, being Gillingham manager, I've got to be honest. Obviously I thought it went really well as a group, was in a real dark place, football club was in a real dark place, a real interesting period for me to see a new owner come in and work within a new ownership structure, and what can be achieved with running a football club properly. Obviously I've been used to football clubs being run properly, to see it the way it was and then a new owner come in was really interesting, really, really enjoyable, I've got to be honest, even in dark times, really enjoyable, the change. It was a really interesting project, and then just sort of, yeah.
Did you think you'd have more of a break between jobs, or was the fact that it was a bit of a surprise, did that gear you up to go, actually, no, I want to get back into management quite quickly?
When between Millwall and Cardiff, I think it was 3 weeks.
Oh wow!
So that was quite a quick turnaround. So when I resigned at Millwall, it's because I needed change. I needed a break. I thought Millwall needed a change as well, but it was only 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Got for two jobs, and I chose the Cardiff one. And I'm pleased I did. When I left Cardiff, I needed a break.
Yeah.
And that'd been sort of almost over 6 years continuously as manager, with COVID in the middle of it as well, which was difficult for everybody. So I then took a year off, went to Gillingham for the right reasons, under false pretenses to a certain degree, but for the right reasons. When I left Gillingham, I'm not, I've said I'll come on and be really honest, bitter when I left. I was disappointed with the way it was handled, and you know, being told I didn't have my job any longer for no reason whatsoever. And I thought, do I want another little break or not?
Yeah.
Got offered two good jobs that I chose not to take, partly down to location, as well as wasn't the right fit for me ownership-wise. And then this one became available, and it was just right straight away. Mm-hmm. I was just the moment I got a phone call to say Mark had left, and that you know, would have been interested in having a cup of coffee. It was just wasn't an interview, just a cup of coffee. I think my wife responded quicker than I did. I think she was that excited for me, because we'd always come back to Cambridge and visited and talked about it, and I'd always followed Mark as well as a manager and knowing him and whatever in the football club because of my connections. It was just too good a fit. Just when I was starting to think about Christmas with the family and some
what a way to ruin
plans.
That.
Yeah. and then as soon as I met the football board, and then as soon as I met Paul, I had a couple of hours with Paul. What a guy. This is for me. So it was really fast. It was really fast, but it was just right from day one.
Okay, so yeah, let's crack straight into the United stuff.
Should we mention Graham Daniels? Because you mentioned the board just a second ago. We've obviously mentioned him a few times in the pod so far, playing under him. Was it weird sort of coming into an environment where someone you know, you have a good friendship with, is kind of like a senior stakeholder in your sort of your new organisation? Or was it a smooth thing having him there?
No, it's great, I've got to be honest. To make that transition into a new job, to have someone like Graham in the background is great. Obviously, Graham's not hands on; don't see him every day. You know, he's there to support the football club. Mm-hmm. But also, having dealt with Ben Strang over a number of years, you know, having that sort of relationship with Ben as well was really handy. So having that connection, knowing Barry Corr, knowing Lawrence Bloom in the sports science and medical department, having sort of played against Kev Betsy.
Nice.
A long time ago as well. So knowing quite a lot of people, And obviously with the players, believe it or not, tried to sign quite a lot of the players over the years.
Well, we've got a question about that.
And
yeah.
played against a couple of them as well. Won't mention any names.
Yeah. Yeah, Michael Morrison won't guess, I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah, well, I was actually going to ask, like, are you all right in saying who those players were that you tried to sign?
Tried to sign Michael more than one occasion. Yeah, nice. That's for sure. Tried to sign Danny Andrew.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. James Brophy.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. George Thomas.
Quite a few then.
Yeah. I don't think it was ever in a position to be able to attract Jordan Cousins.
No.
But they're straight off the top of my head, those ones. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So in that time between sort of your relationship with Cambridge as a city, from City to United, had you sort of kept an eye on what both clubs were up to in that intervening years? And like, do you, because United have been, we were just sort of locking around, well, we were out of the league.
Out of the league for what, nearly 10 years, yeah.
Had you always looked at United and been like, oh, they're sort of, I don't know, just sort of kept an eye for how we were doing, just thought like they need to get themselves back in the league and get pushing back to where you might remember them?
You do naturally. Mm-hmm. You know, you have an affiliation with somewhere, you do. So obviously I'm not a Cambridge United fan, haven't been. But because of my connections with City, I just always have done. Always have done, you know, large part of it is being a Southend fan, being used to Friday night football.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously used to have Cambridge United as well. You know, and it sounds really bizarre and people won't always sort of, but that's a connection for me. Friday night football is a connection. Tranmere Rovers is another one.
Yeah.
Always done Friday nights. So I've always, weirdly, always liked going there, Prenton Park as well. Just because of that, I've played there on a Friday night a couple of times. City, yes, of course, I've followed over the years because of my relationship with Dano. So I've been to various events and over the years to try and support, etc. So just always followed United as well and seen sort of coming out of the league, then going back into the league, etc. And then obviously this huge success over the last sort of 5 years. So it's just goes back to a natural fit. I think just as football people, we do. You're attracted to certain clubs.
Yeah.
I guess when you were at City, I think we were talking about earlier, we must have been like Division 4, then you moved away, and then McFarlane got us up, and then we came back down, and we went out of the league.
And then almost went bust.
Almost went bust, and all this. Where do you see, before you got the job, where did you see Cambridge United? Did you see them as like a Division 4 team, League 2? Or did you see them as a bit more of a bigger club, they should be sort of in a higher division, and now you're here, do you feel like this is a club that is, you know, with the new training facilities and the plans for the grounds, does it feel like it's a club that's kind of catching up with the potential that it has?
Yeah, because I feel like as fans, I feel like we always talk about, and obviously, like, we're from Cambridge, so, like, we think of it a bit different, but it's like a world-famous city. Like, it's the name is so famous worldwide, right? And it feels like we've never, as a club, like, matched that, the potential that the city...
Of what the brand can be.
Exactly,
yeah.
And obviously the next few decades, the way the club's been run at the moment, you know, fingers crossed that starts to happen. But I wondered if that was any... Yeah, basically what George's asking, if that was anything that you thought.
I think if I look at from the outside, as an outsider, you're looking and saying, what... If I look... And again, as football fans, we're pitching whole teams to what they are. I'd say, what's Cambridge United been known as? For me, certainly not a non-league team, for sure. I know it's a spell out the league, but it's almost, in some ways, a yo-yo team between the old Division 3 and 4, which is now League 1 and League 2.
Yeah.
So when I went and had a coffee with the guys, first of all, you know, we sat and we just talked in general for a while. And then my first question to the guys was like, what's expectation? You know, what does the club want to achieve? And Graham and Ben talked me through what Paul's plan is over the next sort of 3, 4, 5 years. And I was astounded. It was so refreshing. It was just like sitting with John Berylson.
Wow.
Nearly 10 years ago as about to be a Millwall manager, and just the thought process, build it over a period of time, not running before you can walk, wanting to build through transfer windows, wants to take the football club in the right direction, i.e. you know, get to the championship, build a brand of a football club that epitomises what the city stands for, as a Cambridge lad growing up. It was so refreshing that it was an amazing opportunity. So now I'm inside, and I get fortunately to work at Clare College every day and see the training facility and how that can still develop and grow. To see the plans for the stadium that's owned by the football club, which is not always the way that nowadays. You know, it's a really exciting project, and to be able to be part of building that at the start is really exciting, and just hope it can add some value to it and help the club on the pathway to success where it's going to go.
Does it motivate you to sort of want to be here long term? Do you be like, you know, I've seen the staging plans, I want to be on the touchline when that new stand here.
We just talked about about society moves so fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. For me, I look at short, mid, and long term.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I said in my first interview, short term was really to get through next Saturday.
Yeah.
mid terms to get through sort of a transfer window. So yeah. from this one,
4 days ago.
Yeah, short term now be literally the next couple of weeks. Mid term for me now is to get through this season. The longer term is looking at sort of the next probably year after, mm-hmm, you know, the next 13-15 months, to be honest.
Nice.
But for the football club as a whole, the bigger picture has got to be the next 5 years is the longer term plan, and the club's got some, as you guys know, it's got some great plans, and they will do it because Paul's driven, you know, he wants it for his football club. You know, he's a proud Cambridge man, and you know, it will happen. So it's a hugely exciting period for this football club. Yeah, it's good times ahead.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
just got to pick points up quickly this year.
Yeah. I was going to ask then about the man you replaced, who it sounds like you had a relationship with, Mark. Who I've only just clocked. He was at Southend for so many years. So is that where you guys know each other?
That's where first came across Mark, and then sort of when I was playing, started sort of my coaching pathway. Mm-hmm. You know, Mark was there, but more just. Sort of come across him, games, friendlies, played each other, and just try and help managers that maybe slightly younger than me, just offer some advice.
Yeah.
So when I got off the job, I spoke to Mark, and first thing I just said to him, he said, "Hello, Chop, how are you?" I said, "Yeah, good." Yeah. He said, "Do you enjoy it?" Yeah. I said, "I just want to ring and say thank you, because what he's done here is amazing. You know, what Mark Bonner's achieved at Cambridge United is fantastic, and it's important. I praised him in my first interview and will continue to praise him because what he's helped build is terrific. And I done my first job 4.5 years. For Mark to get to 4 years is a wonderful achievement. I'm sure he'll be enjoying his break at the moment. But I just want to follow that good work. So I had that connection with Mark, and obviously, like I said already, with Barry and Lawrence Bloom more so than anybody else. But there's good staff at the football club as well.
Was it hard to like follow someone with such a unique story to the club? Because I always like Mark.
Well, just a unique story in football, isn't it? A fan who's gone on to manage the team that he was a fan of and do such a good job. Like, you might have another 100 jobs in football, and you probably won't follow someone who's done that again.
Yeah. Is that something you ever think about, or do you just look at it from a football perspective? You just go, he's had a brilliant 4 years.
So just an insight, what you do in your first few days is you just get to know people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just get to know, build relationships with people. And it's not, I said in my first message to the players was, it's not revolution, it's evolution. Mm-hmm. You know, don't panic, it's not everyone's going to be out the door and it's new players. It's not that at all. It's about working out what's working, what's not working. Mm-hmm. There's a reason a new manager comes into a football club. It's either somebody else has been tapped up and gone somewhere else, or it's because things haven't gone quite right for a period. So something just needs to adjust. So that's all I just had to work out, what just needs adjusting. What I found is, you know, a fantastic setup, well-disciplined group. For me, it's just trying to be myself more than anything. I followed Ian Holloway, Neil Warnock and Steve Evans into jobs. Three vastly more experienced managers than me. So coming in after Mark it's been really enjoyable, I've got to be honest.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah.
Did the move itself, was it something that I know you said you got the call, but was it something that you'd eyed up? When you're out of work as a manager, do you go and like scout different clubs that you think you'd be a good match for? Go and like watch different teams that you think where a job might come up? I know it sounds like
I go the other way. I go to watch games where I think managers are safe.
Right.
Yeah.
So when I saw the news, I was massively surprised. So it did come a bit of a surprise to me. Yeah, I'm. There are people out there who will go and watch teams where they think managers are under pressure. I'm the other way. I like to watch managers aren't under pressure. I like to learn what I'm watching. I want to learn about players, and it's nice to watch a game when there's no pressure involved as well. So you want to learn about players, but you want to watch how two teams play, style of play in and out of possession, how managers adjust during a game, etc. So you're going to learn. Yeah, it was a surprise to me.
It's one of them things, isn't it, that I think it's one of the things that fans just know nothing about. So there's this expectation that, like, you know, like managers are watching each other. Like, it's obviously much more like respectful than that, isn't it? Mm. And I think people think there's just a lot of like almost like snaking going on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because did you say you were at the Northampton game? I can't remember when
Northampton. No, I came to Shrewsbury.
That's it.
Shrewsbury
yeah.
home. Yeah, I'd come to that. Enjoyed watching that.
Mm-hmm. Michael Morrison scored a absolute bouncer.
Mike scored. Yeah, and so I left about 85 minutes. It was 1-0.
Oh god! Yeah.
Really enjoyed the game.
There was a point on Saturday against Burton, quite late on. Morrison just picks the ball up on halfway line and he starts strolling. I was like, here we go.
Desperate times,
desperate measures. Do it again.
The difference was Burton had nine players and the goalkeeper behind the ball and at that time, whereas Shrewsbury were a little bit more open.
And the referee. Anyway.
That's one thing we can't talk about today, the referee.
Let's not go into that. We were going to ask about the club structure. Just, I know it's obviously quite popular. I think it's majority of clubs now have a director of football.
You mentioned Strang earlier.
Is that something that you've worked in before, and is it a way you like to work?
I'm really open minded. You know, the managerial job is so intense now, so many different ways of doing it, that you do need, the board needs somebody between them and the manager, but I think it's good for the manager to have somebody between him and the board, especially when you're going to a new club as well, you know, because it takes time to build those relationships. I get on brilliantly with Paul. He was over at the moment. It was great to see him at the weekend. He came in the training ground Friday. It's a good few hours of us, so that was really nice. But it is important to have somebody between. It's because it's not just about dealing with an owner in between or a football board. You know, you've got to put recruitment. You've got, you know, training grounds based. It's only, as we know in Cambridge, it's only 3.5 miles, but it takes about half hour to get to the stadium. So somebody in between, someone to oversee travel, kit, you know, we have to prepare food. You know, there's loads to go into it all. And then you get to the stage, we start looking at pre-season fixtures and tours, etc. So having a sporting director, in Ben's case, or a director of football, or whatever term you want to call it, to have somebody in there is really key. Ben's a really, really good guy.
I think that's a great answer, because I think it's quite easy for that role to be questioned by fans when things maybe don't go quite as you're expecting them to, or things don't move at the pace that you're expecting them to. Like this window is a great example. Like, oh, where's the signings? And that's the role that kind of gets questioned straight away. You know, well, what's this person doing on top there? And you just listed out all these things. I was like, I didn't even think about like travel and catering and food and all the logistics. Yeah. Like it's such a great insight to see, like, you know, everything that goes through.
We're talking about
that role.
Basic day-to-day bits there, but it's more a structure of a football club, you know, overseeing. Dom sort of running the academy, but Ben oversees that as well. You know, and that's obviously a huge element of the football club. You know, the pathway for the players to come through our academy into our first team setup. So that's not an easy job.
Yeah,
a director of football, sporting director. That's a big job in the modern game. That is a lot of studying to get to that role. And in the transfer windows, that's the biggest element of it, is the transfer windows and stressful time. And ultimately, as a manager, being in the game a long time, have a lot of connections, but ultimately, sporting director will take the majority of the phone calls.
Yeah.
When you first took over, was it quite obvious what the squad was missing in terms of personnel? Both, like, I don't know. I suppose there's two parts to that question, right? Like positionally, and maybe some characters or something that you needed to sort of bolster the dressing room a little bit. Was that obvious? And also, like, how long does that take? Is that something that you, as a new manager, you come in? Is that like
how long to understand your squad?
You have initial thoughts. So when Mark leaves the job, and then you're looking at all going to go and have a cup of coffee. You know, not an in depth analysis of the squad, but my thoughts from having seen a game and sort of then just done a bit of background on the team before going for the coffee. You're sort of looking and thinking, was it a little bit lopsided, maybe a bit imbalanced, sort of only got sort of like, for example, one right back at the football club, and then, well, can anyone else play there? Not really. Mm-hmm. So you're looking, well, it's just one example.
Yeah.
Then you're saying, well, Fajiri got injured on the Saturday.
Yeah.
You know, and you're thinking, well, okay, what? How many strikers we got? One.
Yeah.
So you're looking, going, well, it's not rocket science to work out where you're a little bit light. So you can, but then you still want to look at it and say, well, okay, transfer window's coming up, but you've got to assess the group. You've got to see who the characters are, who the personalities are. Is there any bad eggs in the group, etc.? And that you can't do that overnight. That takes a little bit of time. So we identified where maybe we need a little bit of change, and then you lose Gassan and Elias in the same game.
Yeah.
On the Friday night, and then you're like, well, then you really are light. So it just highlights even more. So I had some ideas, yes, but you just formulate a bigger sample area once you've been in longer.
And then we go to Oxford and play like the best football I've seen a Cambridge United side play in the first half in years with Sully playing up top. It was absolutely sensational that Boxing Day. I can't believe we come out of that with nothing. We did. We give so much that day. It was
rather frustrating that one. You know, to concede last minute on such a good performance.
He's offside as well, isn't he, the lad?
I'm and it's really, when you watch it back, it was really tight. And let's not go too much.
No.
But the fact that Kieran Brown played for me at Cardiff, and he said to me, "I was definitely offside."
Really?
Thanks, mate. That makes me feel loads better. Yeah.
Safe travel home.
In the short term, gone. This is one. I know what the answer to this is, but I'm going to ask it just to. We asked a few people this morning. Just texted a few mates. Just like interviewing Neil later. Like, let us know if you've got any questions. And one lad just said, "Ask him how confident he is we'll stay up this season." I said, "What do you think he's going to say?"
Right on the spot. I'm only hesitating in the answer. Not again to get too excited or too carried away. What I've seen of us so far, 8 games, 1-3, drew 3, lost 2.
Yeah,
so we've only lost 2 in 8. We've got 12 points in 8 games, which is pretty much playoff form over the course of a season, I think. 1.5 points per game is not far off.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've done well.
Yeah.
We've done well. And on the back of that, you're saying, well, we could have had a point against Oxford. Maybe should have got 3 the other day. Then you're in sort of a little bit dreamland
with it.
So I'm really pleased with the start. Do I think we can get better? Yes, I do think we can get better. Do we need to get loads better in the next sort of 2 months? No, we don't need to get loads better because we need to still be a really difficult Cambridge United side to beat. But there's more to come at the top end of the pitch. I know there is. So I've seen it in small glimpses. Confident we'll stay up. Yes, without being disrespectful to the rest of the league. Yes, I am. I'm conscious of the fact that we need to add a couple of players before the deadline because, you know, we're very light in strength and depth at the moment, and we can't just rely on players being back free from injury in the middle to end of March because anything can happen in rehab. So if I wasn't confident that we'd stay up, I wouldn't have took the job. So, you know, that was before I came in, and since I came in, I've been really, really pleased with the group mentality, and I've got a lot of the performances I've been really, really pleased with. And I try to break games down in half, and barring Leighton Orient at home, second half was disappointing. The manner of the 2 goals,
it's the only one, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Oxford's second half, they were better than us. They beat us in the second half, and but other than that, I'd say that we've not had halves of football where I've actually felt like we're not as good as the opponent, and that's over 8 games. So if you do that over a longer period, I know we've got some good teams to play, you know, Bolton a couple of times, Portsmouth, Barnsley, etc. But we've competed. We were much better than Cheltenham. I know Cheltenham had a dip, but we were much better away from home at Cheltenham. We were better than Oxford for an hour. We were better than Blackpool over 90 minutes. So, you know, I'm confident going into a lot, especially at home, that, you know, we get enough points. And then away from home, Exeter was a start.
Mm-hmm.
Exeter was a start. You know, we didn't play free-flowing football like we did at Oxford or like we did against Cheltenham, where we were brilliant against Cheltenham as well. But we did concede 4 goals in 2 games. We played really well at Blackburn. We were at 5 in. So we've got to find the balance between being really difficult to break down and difficult to beat, but then also having that little bit of flair as well about us on the road. And that's what we've got to get to in the coming weeks.
What I found surprising about the Oxford game, especially the first half, and then parts of the Blackburn game and the Cheltenham game that you just mentioned, was... Yeah, you said it, free-flowing and attacking and quite exciting on the eye. And one of the big things that was always said, sort of just as you were sort of being rumoured for the job and when you were announced, is, you know, Neil Harris teams, ugly football, not very attractive, this, that and the other. And I watched like the first half against Oxford, I'm like, wow, what is there? So like, how would you sort of, I don't know, do you listen to sort of people say, you know, Harris plays this type of football, that type of football, or do you just ignore that and say, you know, it changes from club to club and...
And game to game, I imagine. Yeah. Right? Imagine you set horses for courses a little bit, right? Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes you sort of...
Yeah, some games, some games, teams are set up to dominate the football.
Yeah.
They set the team up to dominate the football in the way they play. I'm not precious about percentage football. I know God bless, it's not like we have to have 60 or 70% of the ball. It's not, I know we had 70% the other day, but I'm not precious about it. I'm not one of those managers. And, you know, again, I look at the maybe my upbringing, you know, played for Millwall for 13 years. You know, it was a lot about blood and thunder and heart, but with some good players as well with ability. So, you know, for me, it's the mix between the two. You know, I ask the players to find a way to beat the opponent. They have to identify space. So is that to play, keep the ball and play through teams, or is it to play over the top? Mm. Well, the opponent can dictate that as well, you know, and how they play. What I've always said to that was we didn't score a lot of goals at Gillingham last season, but we're successful in what we set out to achieve. We achieved really comfortably in the end. And this year, when I left, we didn't score loads of goals, but we were in the top three from the first 10 games. At Cardiff, we scored bundles of goals. At Millwall, lost very few games.
Yeah.
Used to beat most teams, especially at home, and scored loads of goals. So I've never had that thrown at me before until sort of the last 12 months. And I think that's back to the power of social media.
Yeah, it's so true.
What do people want to see? So I understand perception is people want to see dominate the ball and win 4-0 because they see Man City and Liverpool do it. But that's why they pay them players £250,000 a week.
Can I tell you something as well? I don't know if George agrees with me on this or not, right? But there's a couple of clubs in the country, right, who have that real sort of like real identity for how they think they play football. So Swansea, Spurs being two that I can think of. Obviously Man City now.
Mm.
But like really have like a way of playing football that they'd like identify. Their manager has to...
Yeah.
Boring Arsenal.
Yeah, it's a boring Arsenal.
Yeah.
You go, oh, the Spurs way.
Yeah.
What were they last week?
Not winning any trophies.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm big on this. And
No, I'm with you. All I was going to say was I think of all the clubs, we've had our most successful period under John Beck, who played... Famously,
direct.
The worst football you can imagine, but successful.
Mm.
And I think fundamentally, like this is the point you're just making. Like, what would Spurs fans do? Rather play like John Beck and win a trophy, or play like, I can't even think of an example of an old Spurs, but Bill Nicholson and, you know, not win anything or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a bad example because he won a lot for Spurs. But
yeah. That's last time they won it. They won in the 60s. Yeah.
Just in my point, though. Yeah. I feel like.
Yeah. Look, for me, it's. So somewhere in between the two, you know, I want my players to feel valued and trusted to make good decisions. But you have to do that by winning games of football as well. Because if you don't win games of football, then you lose your job. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. Have you got the players? Do you have a budget then able to sign the best players to play a certain way? Sometimes you do, and sometimes you sign players where you take a risk that you know they might be missing something. I think we've got a good core group of players that have got a balance between the two, that can handle the football, but that can also play forward and run forward. And I think in my tenure so far, and even in the short sample of 8 games, I think we've seen both sides of it. I think we've seen really, really compete and stand strong against teams. And if we have to be ugly, then we can. But we've also played really well. And I think even the first half hour the other day, we played really well. And I think if we score in the first half hour, I think that game's completely different.
I think
that game goes 3 or 4 because as soon as Burton had come out of shape, I think we'd have picked them off.
Yeah.
So it's finding the balance between the two. And I think ultimately, this year is about getting enough points as quickly as we can in any format we see fit to win a game of football. I think then once you get to next summer and you get a pre-season and you go into sort of your second transfer window, I think that's when you start seeing a bit more of a balance to what my team might look like.
What I love, Neil, is a little bit earlier when you listed off good teams in the league, you avoided naming a certain team that wears blue and plays up the road from us. Certain big game coming up, not too far off.
Carlisle. Yeah. It's a long road.
Yeah.
The running order just says, please win the derby.
Please win the derby.
Yeah.
Are you aware of what happened the last time we played Peterborough this season? Is that...
I have watched it, yeah.
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 That's going to be a big game.
There's obviously there's like a ton of games before then, right? We're playing all the time in February and it's at the end of the month.
I understand that as well. You saw my first game as Cambridge United head coach was at Cheltenham, and the fans saw their reaction to me on that day. So I've played in a lot of local derbies, hostile derbies. Played Forest Derby, played Millwall West Ham, Millwall Palace, Millwall Cheltenham, played Cardiff Swansea.
Yeah, of course.
And obviously managed in a lot of big games as well. Yeah. So I'm fully aware the Cambridge, Peterborough, you know, Derby, what it's going to mean to the fan base of both teams. They're the games I love.
Yeah.
They're the games I thrive on. They're the games, especially when we're the underdog going into the game. I know we're at home, we're at the Abbey, and, you know, it is a fortress for us, and it's our ground, but it's our ground, it's our atmosphere, it's our ball, and no one comes and takes it off us.
Nice.
So, for me, I understand the magnitude of the game, and, you know, hopefully that reflects in our performance on the day.
God, it's like Braveheart, this.
Yeah.
Last question, I think, because we've kept you for a while as well. You've got to go sign some players, haven't you? sort of longer term a little bit. You actually just sort of touched on it there. Next year, you know, when we stay up, let's go with a when. Yeah. Next year, League One's going to look really interesting because you're going to have Stockport, well, presumably.
Well, if the top three League Two right now, what, Stockport, Wrexham, Mansfield. All money, aren't they?
MK, one of MK or Notts County or someone like that coming up. I just think League One next year is going to be quite a. It's going to be a tough place to
different
be.
Different beast.
It's going to be a bit of a different beast to how we've experienced it before, because it's always been sort of League of Two leagues, right? You know, like big teams at the top, and then you've always got your
haves and your have nots.
Yeah.
Thank you, George. Finishing my sentences for me perfectly. Next year, have you got already? Oh, I assume you're thinking game to game now, and obviously make sure we stay up. But you mentioned there, next year you're going to see a Neil Harris team a bit more. Like, I wondered if you could give us a bit of an insight into what that might look like a little bit, what your plans are in that sense.
I think you look in, you're starting to fear League One next year already.
I
look at it the other way. I look at it and think, well, if there's teams in it with big budgets, could bring them on.
I don't want to see Mullin score again.
He wasn't a bad goal scorer.
I
look and say every league, every season looks tough.
Yeah.
Every league you're in, and then there's always some teams, and you go, well, they just pay 10 grand a week for a striker in League One. That's madness. That's what they do now.
Yeah.
So every league is random. I always say that. League One will be the same next year. Where are we at? Paul wants to build this football club over a period of time. He wants to progress it, and he wants to develop the club on the pitch as well as off the pitch. So, you know, he's putting plans together to be able to sort of increase revenue all the time. And, you know, every level of football, you have to keep moving the times. And we know that as a football club. So, you know, it's getting through this window. We signed Lyle Taylor. You know, I think we've done one today before coming on air. And we need to sign one, if not two more, in the coming days at the top end of the pitch. And that's the start in the first window. Obviously, when you have X amount of players out of contract, some will obviously stay, some will go. Some might be under contract that decide that they're not going to get a game. They want to move on somewhere else. We might sell somebody. And we have the opportunity to transform the side again. And for me, I know what a successful League One team looks like. I know what it looks like. I've seen some teams this year. I've seen us compete in every game and seen where we've done really well and excelled and seen where we've been a little bit light at times. But it's still very early days. You know, we're only 8 games in. Got 19 games left this season. I can't wait to see my players over the next 19 games and how they stand up to it and sort of who stands up to be counted and who sinks at times before we start making bigger decisions come the summer. I don't want to sort of go too far ahead of that because...
One thing at a time.
One thing at a time. We've got to finish this window first.
Yeah.
We've got to get as many points as we can as quickly as we can before starting to think the next one.
Got to beat Borough.
Got to beat
Borough on route. Yeah. But ultimately, I know what a good, successful League One team looks like. You know, I've played in them and I've managed them, and that's what I want us to be. I want us to be a successful League One team, and you have to be good in both boxes.
Yeah.
And you have to be competitive in the middle of the pitch. You have to be able to run with the best of teams, but you also have to handle the football as well, and you certainly have to be very good at set plays.
There we go. What a way to finish us off. I was going to ask, have you got 3 minutes left just to play a game?
Go on.
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
I thought I was getting away with this.
So, really quick. This game's called Football Jenga, right?
Right.
We play it with all our guests on the pod, right? So basically, I'm going to give you a game.
Yep.
You against Jord. You just got to name players that played in that game, right? So one each, all right?
Go on.
Now, okay, the game is Cambridge United 1, Millwall 1. On the, what date was this? 2002-2003 FA Cup round 3. So January 2003. Now, basically, you're going to go first. You go one each. The first two wrong answers, you can name a manager to stay back in. And then once someone gets something wrong, next person, right answer, they win. That's it. Okay? Good?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Cambridge United players first.
Oh, see, I thought you were going to go all the Millwall ones, and then you were going to go all the Cambridge ones.
I'm just trying to think who would have played for Cambridge. Just trying to think.
So this is, 2003. So, Neil, guest goes first. You can go any team, remember?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. I think I played Neil Harris.
Yeah, Neil Harris.
Yeah, that's an easy one.
I was going to see if we got someone else there.
Well, I didn't play, so not me. Paul Wanless?
Correct.
Oh. Yeah, I remember.
King of the Abbey.
I've got the scores 1-1, by the way.
So we'd have been.
You won the replay, mate.
Yeah, we'd have been Championship at the time. So I'd gone with, in that game, I'd go with David Livermore.
Correct. Got booked, unsurprisingly.
That'd have been his, that'd been a 10th game of the season, that'd have been his 10th yellow card.
Cahill? What'd he gone?
He was, for some reason, he's not playing
this game. I thought I was being smart by nicking your obvious Millwall ones.
No, I didn't think, I wouldn't have put him down for playing in that game. I've got a couple of others as well, I don't think would have played.
So hang on, he needs a manager to stay in the game. Either one.
Who's our manager in 03?
Well, no, my one.
Oh, hang on. I haven't got it up here. Don't take too long, George.
I wasn't John Beck again, was it? Was he? Had he gone by that point?
Is that your guess?
Yeah.
I'd have said no.
No.
Yeah, no. You beat us 5-1 and he was in charge. I'm getting my seasons muddled up, I think.
That was 2000.
Oh.
2000. Yeah. I think you got one to win, Neil.
What, player?
Player.
Yeah.
Oh, come on then. I'll go with Matty Lawrence.
Correct.
Hey. Right back.
Do you want the teams? Tony Warner, Matt Lawrence, Nevercott, Ward, Ryan, Kinnett, Ifill.
Ifill. Yeah, sorry. Ifill, he was next game, next one, yeah.
Livermore, Reed, Harris, Claridge.
Claridge.
Claridge was the scorer. And the United team was Marshall, Tan, Duncan, Goodhind, Angus, Knacker, Wanless, Bridges, Tudor,
Ashby.
Youngs, Kitson.
Ashby there? Kitson. God.
Kitson. I was going to go Butler, but no. Kitson. Yeah.
Butler was earlier.
Anyway,
yeah, earlier.
Not a classic.
Can I just point out that
Mark McGee was manager for Millwall?
Yeah.
Cambridge manager was?
I can't get the Cambridge manager up. Hang on. But it wasn't John Beck.
But you know, it's John Beck. Okay.
Yeah. I've looked at John Beck's career and it wasn't him.
Sending that one upstairs? No.
I'll come back to you on the Cambridge manager. Anyway, Neil, thank you so much for coming in, mate.
Pleasure.
It's been great to talk through your career and everything, and up the U's.
Definitely. Thank you, guys.